My Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight we have a really interesting show. This is going to be, for the people in the more scientific bent, this will be right up your alley. If you are afraid of science, you'll still be, I think, interested in this because it'll be explained in different ways so that it won't be hard, I think, that hard to understand. Also, we're going to a two-hour instead of a two-and-a-half-hour format tonight because there is likely going to be a show after this one. And there has been some problems with this station and this, the people they contract with. And there could be some technical problems. If there is, I may not be able to stay on the air because of that. So we will see how things go. Everybody's got their fingers crossed, of course. And tonight's show is Greater Understanding of Time, Space, and Intelligent Activity, which is, of course, God's third part of mind. And I'm going to approach this subject in a more comprehensive way that allows, I think, people who may have read or heard some of the other shows about this, a better way of understanding the concept of time itself. Because time is probably the hardest thing for people to understand. Now, I know people say, well, I read it in the first five pages of your chapter 10 on time and space. Yeah, people read it, but it's pretty hard to understand it because the concepts are huge, and they involve a lot of physics, and that's where people get confused because physics is not just your common sense kind of thing. Some of it is even counterintuitive, at least on the surface it is, and it doesn't lend itself to most people saying, well, yeah, I can understand that. But tonight I'm going to try to make it so it is more understandable, and we'll see how well we do with that. Okay. So let me start off with this simple idea. God wanted a universe that was not controlled by its thought. It didn't want to be the master puppeteer and have everything else just going with whatever it decided things would be like. That's called a deterministic universe, and God didn't want that. So God wanted a non-determined, or indeterminate is the correct word, universe in which there was freedom for people to think, and other things besides people, and for life itself to grow based upon choices that the life makes. And those choices would change the perspective of who and what God is over what we call time. Now, the time issue means something different in God's perspective than it does to most humans. Today, we're going to look at it from God's perspective. So it's a little different than humans generally can or choose to think about it. And so that's the key to really getting more understanding, is to recognize what the Creator wanted and how it designed the universe so that the goal, which I just described, one of the goals, would be, we'll say, would be exercised within the parameters that it set up the universe to do. There's a lot more to it, though, because within this, we'll say, parameter that there's a freedom of choice that is real. It's not some made-up, you know, well, you really don't have any freedom, but we'll pretend like you do. This is real freedom. And that means that God is using life to grow itself, not that it is some kind of paternal or maternal or both, being that just sort of is corralling and doing what it needs to make life do what it wants it to do. It's not that way at all. As a matter of fact, because of this model, we have a lot of contradictory kinds of things that happen, and they aren't necessarily the things that God would say, well, gee, yeah, I want them just like that. God allows it to be because you can't have this indeterminate aspect. Some people in physics call it probabilistic, but there's a little bit of a difference. I'm going to explain that today. And you can't have that if you're going to prevent bad things from occurring to generally what people consider to be good people or good anything. There has to be the allowance for that sort of thing to happen, but even more so, because of time, we as beings, human beings, are confused because we see things in such a limited slice of time. As an example, a lifetime, if at best, most people can't even remember some things from much more than 10 or 20 years ago. And so it becomes very difficult for us to perceive things that seem very upsetting to us. Say, children suffering in some way. Well, why does a child suffer? Well, did it really do anything that would allow that to happen? Well, within the time we perceive its existence, we would probably say no. And for some people, this might mean, well, God's not a very fair God if it does allow that to happen. But what if that same child has several lifetimes beforehand in the physical world where it chose to live out its life as the prior incarnations of that child chose to live out their lives as relatively selfish and non-virtuous kinds of things? And maybe what's happening then is that. I get an email from, and maybe she's listening tonight, Susan from Europe. Okay, we'll call her Susan from Europe. And I know she's been listening to the show for a long time. And, you know, the interesting thing is she sent a picture of a starving child. And that sort of thing is actually based on a perception that the child only exists for this very small time, maybe 5, 6, 7 years or whatever age it is. When in reality, that may be its 500th lifetime in terms of the soul's journey. And so there's karmic issues that come into play. But it also goes beyond that. There's the intricacy of free will is so great that even though there might not even be that much serious problems in a person's prior incarnations, they may suffer because they live within a certain country at a certain time, and there's a relationship karmically with how they lived in that country before, or some other elements that we just have very little understanding about. It gets complicated. And so for us, time is really almost the boogeyman. It doesn't really give us a hint, almost, of what is the truth. And tonight, I'm going to open that, we'll say, that really tightly closed box and try to expose what is time itself and how come it's so crucial for God's development and our development that we have these wider perspectives of time that are happening where we don't see them because we can't perceive them with the senses that we have while we're physically alive, and barely can even while we're in the mental world before we become our souls. Souls have a bit better perspective of time, but even the human soul, because it is locked in the very narrow part of the higher mental world, it doesn't have that great of an understanding of time either. Although it does recognize some of the conditions that I'm going to be explaining. So God wants to have a universe that is free and that promotes something we call love or consciousness, understanding, all the same idea, parts of it, to develop in the life that is free to choose to develop itself. And consciousness is the part of life that joins together pieces of knowledge, and knowledge is the joining together of bits and pieces of information. It's So you got information coming through senses, and the information is joined together sometimes by, in our case, a personality that subconsciously joins together into knowledge. And the knowledge then is either used without, we'll say, further joining and further connections, and if it is, then it stays pretty much as knowledge. But when we choose to do something creative with the knowledge and join it in new and unique ways and see how it connects to help and serve other things, we call that love, I realize, but then our consciousness grows. That's what consciousness is. It's the ability to take the knowledge and apply it to new and more and bigger things. And that's part of God's plan, is that not only is there growth in senses and awareness, and not only is there growth in eventually knowledge that comes from the information from the senses, but eventually there is growth, hopefully, in consciousness, all based upon the choices made by life itself. And the interesting part about this is there's a third part to God's mind. You've got the freedom part, which has to do with the choices and the creation and the purpose and all that stuff. And you got the consciousness part, which comes from having senses and knowledge that eventually becomes consciousness. But the last part of this equation has to do with interaction. We are individuals, and life can be conceived as an individual thing, but we are also capable and can choose to be connected together through the, we'll say, common element of God. The connection of all of us together through God allows us to then super grow in consciousness. And the growth in consciousness I described a minute ago is really on an individual scale, because I was describing it that way. But there's another kind of consciousness. We'll call it soul consciousness, or beyond soul, even to monadic consciousness, or bigger kinds of consciousness. But those kinds of consciousness involves the ability to sense others, in God in others, and how all together, collectively, can grow and become, we'll say, more like their creator. And that's a good thing. The opposite is done by evil. Evil says, let's get rid of God. We don't want any God. And we'll grow in, quote-unquote, non-consciousness. It's a crazy idea. We'll grow in a way in which the only consciousness that we choose to be is ways to understand how to be more destructive to God and those that are on the side of God. Well, okay, if that's what gets you off, fine. But the problem is that eventually ends up destroying the consciousness even of evil. So it's a weird kind of system because it's self-defeating, but you can't convince them of that, so they go off in that way. And because the system is free, God doesn't intervene in it. God says, okay, you want to be stupid? Go that way. You'll find out what alley that goes to. And eventually it leads to self-destruction and to extreme suffering. But in the short term, or relatively short term, it may look like evil is in some way getting somewhere in this destructive process. Because obviously, for a while, it can destroy life. And life is God's growth, so it's affecting its creator, which it may adhere to the idea that there is no such thing. Of course, it does that just for the benefit of others, because in reality, truly evil beings, no God exists. They just want to destroy it. But to the ones that aren't quite in that category, they try to convince those folks or beings, generally people, though, that God doesn't exist. It's easier that way. Okay, so getting back to where God is looking, we'll say, at a universe that is free, that is free to grow in consciousness, universal love, and that has intelligent interaction, which is actions between one part of life and any other part of life that conveys, and it may not, it may be pre-life, so you can even get down to atoms and, I mean, really, really non-life kinds of looking like non-life kinds of things, that is communicating perfectly. But what is perfect communication? Perfect communication is relative. This is the strange thing about God. God starts out with intelligent activity, being at the level of God itself at the beginning of this process. But each part of life that grows a bit more intelligent in its interaction, which contributes to the overall level of God. So God is continually growing from the process, and therefore it's a moving target. It isn't the same today as it was a million years ago, or maybe even yesterday if you get really technical. So it's changing constantly, and the more it changes, the more it means to obviously have to grow a bit more in order to achieve some level of perfection in activity that is godlike. Now remember, you can have all other kinds of activities that are less than godlike. A godlike activity means that the communication between one part and the other part, we'll say, of life, is perfect that there is no use or waste of any energy, and energy becomes literally a non-factor because actually no energy is expended. It's an energy-less model. All energy is converted into light, and the result is there is no expenditure of energy. It's hard for us to conceive of this because in physics, there is such a thing as what I'm describing in physics, but it is so seldom examined because it so seldom happens, at least in the world that we're familiar with, which is right here on Earth. But it does happen, and it happens frequently if you look at some stars and a lot of other things. It's just that common, like you don't see it going on here on Earth all the time. Here we have huge amounts of energy, especially in the physical dimension, that produce a lot of different forces, and the energy is the result of a less than perfect activity between two or more of anything. Energy is the result. Wow. So it's hard for us to conceive of that. And the funny thing about this now, we're getting to the time part. The funny thing about this is that time, yes, the thing we call time, is what happens when you don't have perfect activities. Perfect activities take no time at all. They literally happen at the speed of light, which means time stops, of the dimension that you're in. And so at that point, it's pointless to talk about either the exchange of energy or the use of time. Time becomes in existence because the universe is far less than perfect. At the very beginning of the universe, time got a little bit confused, literally, by a thing called inflation. What's that? It's not stuff about money now. We're talking about physics. There was such a huge amount of excess energy with very few levels of intelligent interactions because the universe was all mushy, this is at the beginning of the universe, that for a period of time, even the speed of light didn't matter anymore, and literally the universe grew for like 300,000 years or so, give or take, much faster than the movement of what we call the speed of light in this dimension that we exist in. And it still boggles many physicists' minds that actually happened. They don't have a good explanation for it, but I know what happened. I'm describing it to you. That the point is that everything was upside down in the beginning, and so there was virtually no intelligent activity. Intelligent activity had to literally be worked out. And so within these 300,000 or so years before there was the formation of virtually anything other than a big cloud of energy, there was such a lack of it that literally energy reached a point where it was no longer even responding as what we call energy anymore. It was in a state, we'll call it, of being so non-intelligent as to grow from the darkness around it rather than through light. The interesting thing about that model, and I have to be careful what I say here, is the evil side of existence has used that model so it can traverse the whole universe these days, almost the whole universe, as we understand the physical universe, anyway, within a very short period of time, like seconds, without obeying the laws of what we'll call the physics of light. So, I mean, that's just an example of how strange things can be once you start going to the extremes of such as an example of non-intelligent activity. And, of course, remember, evil chooses to not use intelligent activity. It chooses to avoid it and to reverse the process in ways that I'm not allowed to talk about. But the point is that when it does this, it can actually do things that we think are impossible. That's strange, isn't it? All right, so time, as we perceive time, is not as definite as, for heaven's sake, you could have time that literally it takes almost no time, where there's no light, which doesn't make any sense, or you could have extreme light where it takes no time either, because you have perfected intelligent activity, which is the mind you've gotten back, you're creating more of the mind of God. Now, the intelligent activity side of God's mind is the third part of God. And that third part is really where, we might say, the rubber hits the road, where things make a difference on a moment-to-moment basis in how the universe turns out. There is something called an event, the word event in physics. I use it in the textbook, Life's Hidden Meaning. And an event really has to do with this whole idea of there being an energy model. Okay, we have an energy model on the physical side. We can understand that. But the energy model is misunderstood in the standard model of physics because energy is the outcome of time separating from space because the activities that are taking place in the event are not in God's mind. They're outside of God's mind. And therefore, it takes more and more time and more energy is a result of it as the effect. So what we think of as energy, where does energy come from? Energy comes from separating time from space. If you didn't separate any time from space, then an activity would be perfectly intelligent and no energy would be manifested. We would not have what we think of as an energy-based universe. In the beginning of this particular universe we're in, there was a huge amount of energy because it was almost totally separate, because time was almost totally separated from space. There was so much energy that it could exceed the speed of light because time itself, there was a change in the ratio of time and space. You could say that time became completely, or almost completely at the Big Bang, separated from space. And at that particular point, as I said, there's this inflation thing. The energy itself was able to move far beyond the speed of light, 1,000 times, like really fast, which happens to be the upper limits of the monastic dimension. And it's not a coincidence that that's the case. So, because that's the farthest you can go and still be in the anything that we call the denser part of our universe. Sounds strange, but the mental dimension is still dense, but it's relatively dense compared to the intuitional dimension, which is vastly non-dense. All right, so there's a big separation there. And it's sometimes referred to as the cosmic solid part of the universe. Solid meaning that there's some substance to the energy which still responds based upon the time model that I just described. When you get to the intuitional and beyond, things start changing in terms of what we call time. Time begins to take on a greater and greater reflection of God, because more and more of it is joined with space. And as time joins with space, it literally takes no time to do a lot of things. And you can do amazing things if you're in the intuitional body and mind. A human being even can think of things in virtually what we call no time, do the impossible kinds of stuff. But it really isn't impossible. It's just joining together time with space. When you do that, you got all the time you need, because you're not using any time to achieve anything. Also, you're not using any energy. It's called an energy-free model. So the energy is not manifested. Now, it does become manifested in when the intuitional thought is brought into the mental body. Then the energy has to be manifested. It has to, because that's the physics of the mental body. Yeah, be careful, because all that energy, if it isn't used in the correct way, could do some real bad things. But usually people who do this sort of stuff know that and have ways of making it work, or if they don't, they're not going to be doing it very long. So the important thing about this is to look at the model and to understand that God created a system that says, here's the perfection. If you are in perfection, time as you understand it, as we all understand it, isn't really there. But if you want to create life and give it free choice, it's going to make all kinds of, we'll call it, bad choices, and be not loving all the time, which is what we call the two together spiritual. So that can be part of God's thinking. And so the results are the actions and interactions it has are going to be not anywhere near perfect. They're going to be so imperfect as to produce huge amounts of manifested energy, and a lot of time is going to be separated from space. The results are, we call, wasting or making mistakes, wasting time. Well, we do it all the time, right? All the time. We are wasting time because we're selfish, right? And that's all waste of time. Every mistake a human being makes is a mistake away from the Creator. All right, so God has this. And another way to look at time, and this is, I've written about this, this is a fascinating explanation of time, is that time is also the measure that a person is selfish. The longer time it takes for anything to happen, or you could say the greater forces that are produced, you can use that model too. Either one is true. Either one, the lower the consciousness of the person or any entity, anything, is, and the less it's like its creator. Very interesting. So that's another way of saying, you could say a time is a measure of consciousness, and how much the consciousness of someone is either like their creator or not like their creator. Yeah. Getting it even a little deeper, you could say, how much is the overall thought either like the creator or not like the creator? Although, technically speaking, you don't have to include the first part of thought, which is creation. If you're fully conscious, even if you're not creating at the moment, you still won't take any time. But if you want to do it for any consistent number of times, we'll call it, I don't want to say you want to do it for more time because you're using less time, but more consistency in the model if you're going to keep doing it, then you do need to consider it as total thought and not just of consciousness. But on a mini scale, just looking at any specific interaction, it's consciousness that is the value that the time is actually measuring. So if something takes time and produces more forces, either one of those two, because they're both going on at the same time, we may not notice one or the other, then the result is the consciousness is lower than it needs to be part of the love of God at that time. And remember, that all changes as everything in the universe is growing more of God. So today's ability to create or co-create with our Creator is a slightly fraction bit higher than it was yesterday, because there's more creation of our Creator all the time in the universe. although it varies. Now, could you go backwards? Yes. There is a backwards to this model. That's what evil is trying to achieve. But it rarely does. And when it doesn't, at least in as far as I am aware, it does it only infrequently and in very narrow regions of the universe. But that's still not a good thing. So don't think that we should celebrate that or something. Okay. So again, now we're starting to see that time is this variable thing, and when it's connected to the mind of God, which is the third part of God's mind, it doesn't take any time in which to interact with anything else, to take any action whatsoever, and it also requires no energy to do so. Now, energy is manifested. And gravity, as we understand it, also ceases to exist as a force because it joins with the other three forces of the universe. And when that takes place, we have something what is called a forceless system. The reason there are forces is because the four forces that are recognized by physics become separated, and they then interact in ways that fouls up, we'll call it, the system. Also, it makes it difficult to interact in the future. So it becomes a roadblock. Our prior selfishness becomes a roadblock to our future selfishness, and that's called karma. All right? So when we separate forces, or we separate energy and produce forces, and when we separate time from space, we produce a thing called karma. If time is not separated from space, there's no such thing as karma. Karma is a delay because of forces from one activity to the next. There's no delay in activities if time is joined in the third part of God's mind and there aren't any forces. The forces go away. If you take all of the energy and put them together, then you don't have a force anymore because they balance each other out, and they much more easily rejoin with time and become a inseparable part of God's mind. This thing we call space becomes light. So all of the space turns into an existence of light. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that you're in a timeless place in which you could live in the past, the present, or a virtual future of the present universe. And that virtual future, depending upon your level of development, if you are creating it to the highest level you can create at, it's even possible to go to the end of your own existence within that particular model. Not the existence of God. God could do it possibly, but we can't. So we can live out a model to the end of our existence, which is pretty far out there. Now, once you do that, by the way, you're done. You don't stay in this universe. You go on to another one. But the point is that this is an amazing model because, again, what we're talking about in time is really an effect of what a lot of people would commonly call selfishness. Time is the effect of the universe being imperfect. Wow. Isn't it strange? All right, so what do I mean by a virtual universe? Well, God gives us freedom to choose, and as soon as that is given, and as soon as that is adhered to, there's a non-deterministic universe, indeterminate, and the result is that every second new choices are being made, which changes the outcome of everything. So we are creators, and in our creations, we are changing what will be in the future. So what we call the future of time is really changes in the level of which time is going to, the level and amount that time will separate from space sometime into the future that we project to, and we then make changes in who and what and how we're going to interact with, so that the results will be more and more godlike in their part, playing the part in God's mind, in God's third part of mind. So this is the most interesting part, in my opinion, about this whole model, is that each of us has the opportunity to play out some of this and to even live in the future. I know that sounds so hard to understand, but it's more difficult for us to perceive it here in the physical world because you have to get really close to the speed of light, which we don't even come near that, where we are. And so the only place you really get to something like that is in the mental world. Even there, it's very difficult to go very far projected into the future. A lifetime is difficult because it's mostly done in the lower mental world where you're still not even close to what would be considered the speed of mental light. But it is faster than the speed of light here in the physical world. So that gives us a kind of ability, we'll say, if you're in the mental world, which people eventually will be, and you can actually live out a good part, if not all, of various versions of what will be your next lifetime, interacting with hundreds of other souls incarnates working with you, doing this amazing thing of creating virtual realities, seeing how best to get closest to perfecting the interaction so that there is little force and little time, and it's more like God's mind. That's what we're going to be doing. And everything I'm talking about today, everything I'm teaching about, will be eventually done by all of us, or virtually all of us, in the mental world, in our future. And then we'll come back and reincarnate here. Well, we're going to take a little break at this point. That was a lot, huh? And when we come back, yes, I'm going to still try to make this as easy as possible. I know that was a lot to think about, but it may be helpful. We're going to talk about things called tachyons and other stuff. They're fancy words for something that I will explain how the universe further works, and I think you'll enjoy it. So we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes, give or take, from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight's show is on greater understanding of time, space, and intelligent activity, which is God's third part of mind. And I think that if you've listened so far, it might be starting to gel a little that time is not anything like what people think it is. We tend to think of it almost like it's this absolute, you know, 1 hour, what, 2 hours, 3 hours. It's got some kind of regimen to it and everything. Yet, as I'm describing it, time is extremely malleable, even non-existent if you create enough of virtue or light and form. You actually aren't even held by it at all. You can be beyond time, which is a little bit, you know, almost into the science fiction, like, whoa, that's even science fiction, though, doesn't use this concept the way I'm describing it tonight. I haven't yet seen it used that way. It would be a great thing to use because it is in fiction, in my opinion. It would certainly open the eyes to a lot of people because science has a hard time with, fiction has a hard time with describing a time that doesn't have paradoxes and problems in it. When there's the desire to time travel or change time in any dimensional fashion. Now, remember, time is intricately part of space. You can't fully separate time from space in our universe, because you would be outside of it. You wouldn't be in the universe anymore. That actually did happen at one point during the Big Bang. It also happens every time something enters a black hole for a brief period. Now, the black hole is very interesting because it has to go through different dimensions of time and space with the energy from this particular dimension being transmuted, is the word, into the energy of higher dimensions. And as it does that, as it raises the energy level, it emits things called tachyon particles and other stuff that has to do with changing the relationship of the energy to space and time, so that it's becoming more and more enlightened. So eventually the black hole is converting energy into light, but not light here, as stars do, because the black hole was originally a star, but converting it into light in other dimensions. Mostly, the majority of it goes into the place called the Atmic dimension. But it also can feed some energy into the intuitional, maniacic, or astral dimensions as well. And so you have this recycling, we'll call it, of energy, changing it more and more into light, and light in different modes. And strangely, when it does this, it emits particles. The particles are the past parts of time, which remain as part of the dimension from which the energy last was transmuted from. And so it's a kind of a strange thing. You could say these particles are actually moving backwards in time. And they in some respects, that's exactly what they are doing. The other fascinating part about this is that black holes are not the only producers of this effect. There's all kinds of things that can cause some of the same effect. There is a giant black hole in almost every galaxy, and that black hole is in the center of the galaxy, and most of this transmuting is taking place there in comparison to all the other black holes put together, and it is producing a lot more tachyons. So if we got near and could measure the tachyons coming out of every part of our galaxy site, we would find that the majority are coming from the center of our galaxy. Now, what does that mean? Well, because these particles are also partly a wave, there's no real thing as a particle. A particle is really part of a wave, and together they actually are part of an energy force that is separated from a state of perfected activity, so, and they're also part of time. But in the case of tachyons, they tend to be part of the more, we'll call it, past part of time. So if you were to tune in to the to that part of our galaxy, you could relive major parts of the past part of time. You could actually enter into the past. Not a past as this is somewhat often done in science fiction, that you could enter in and change, but a past that you could experience both as an observer, you could interact with, but it would have no changeable effect because the particles are impervious to any other energies from our dimension. That's the odd thing about tachyons, is they're non-reactive to other kinds of energies because they are in the past of time. It's a very strange thing. But you could interact. You could interact in some ways, but it would have no effect on changing the past. And this is what has been so confusing about science fiction, because the idea of something called the temporal paradox, whereas if you could really change the past, then you could change it in ways so that you may not exist anymore, or everything might cease to exist, so that the future where you came from couldn't have existed, so you couldn't have gone back to change the past, and et cetera. And, you know, it's got all those, it's called sometimes called the grandfather effect. You go back and you shoot your grandfather. Well, how could you do that? Because you didn't exist then to do that. I mean, you can go into these paradoxes. But you can't with tachyons, and you could, therefore, live in the past of time. Now, I'll tell you this, that in some other dimensions, particularly the monastic dimension, there's a part of that dimension called the Akasha. You probably have heard of this. It's not a book. A lot of people think you walk into some kind of textbook or something. I don't know. It came from a misunderstanding of the word itself. But at any rate, you can actually participate in the past of time. And you don't really change the past, but you can have an effect on the present and the future by interacting with the past, because you change. And you change, and others people may change, and the ability to think in the present may change. So that is a part of change that can happen. And interestingly, Akashas, there's an Akasha on the in the astral world too. They have a connection to the physics of tachyons. They're not. It isn't totally composed of tachyons. Not as we understand tachyons, but remember that those are other dimensions where tachyon particles have a different characteristic to them, so calling them tachyons really wouldn't be a fair thing, but they are connected to what we call tachyons, and they have a different way of interacting because the physics change, a thing called the quantum constant, is much greater. When you change the quantum constant, gravity becomes much less, and the speed of light grows. Well, okay, that's a little beyond maybe what we want to talk about. That's I'm just giving you information that may not be really that important. But the important thing to realize here is that the past has a different quality to it. You can interact with the past more easily, and it can change you in the present more easily. But it doesn't, you don't actually change the past. You change the effects of the past on the present and into the future. But you don't change the past itself. It's a little hard to understand that, I know. But at any rate, that's what goes on. And tachyons are actually playing a part there, too. And it's pretty interesting how this all fits together. Tachyons originate in at the top of the atmic plane, the third plane of existence. That's where time and energy and the third part of actions exist in an interactive way. The monadic plane, all intelligent interaction is held at bay. It's kept in the surrounding outside perimeter of the monadic plane because monads choose to not become interactive so that the life they help to create below their plane will have more of an opportunity to do so, because if they did become interactive, we wouldn't have much of a chance to grow because they'd be going way beyond us. Their consciousness is so great. They realize that, so they sacrifice that, as God did in the first place. And so they don't do so. They eventually can live outside of their time, but they choose to live not in the past or the present. They eventually choose only to live in a virtual future, and that's called an ascended monad. And they only exist not on the monadic plane, but on a place called logoic, or the first dimension of our universe, where at the top of that dimension, God exists. So they are becoming godlike. But those monads that get into that dimension, they only get there by having advanced so much life to become intelligent in its activity that they are literally experts, we'll say, true experts at creating intelligent activity in the past and the present. And so much so that they can now join virtual futures that are very, very close to being perfect right from the very beginning, and eventually, before they leave the universe, they are perfect at it. Wow. That's the amazing thing about time. Talk about malleable. Think about it. These beings are becoming experts at governing and changing how time eventually is not separated from space, and how they can actually live out in the future whole existences. Just an amazing thing. Just an amazing thing. And for them, at that moment, that is a perfect future. However, the future changes as each being adds to it. So that's the future at the moment they're doing it. That's perfect. But it will not be the ultimate future that God itself finds itself in, because that's after everything in the universe has ascended. And there's nothing left except God. God has fulfilled its own growth in this universe to grow at its maximum level without it doing itself, but by creating life and allowing, encouraging, producing a system that life can then co-create with its creator to the maximum level possible. Even evil will eventually get out. Eventually. It may find it tough, but it will eventually find a way. So this is a fascinating way of looking at this third part of God's mind, because now it's we can get a tangible, I'll call it that. Maybe you don't think it is by the way I just described it, but I consider it a tangible way of approaching it. You can almost feel it. You can say, yeah, I think I can see how this thing works. Even if you don't understand the physics like I might. And I might say I'm the world's greatest physicist. I'm just saying I think I got the whole picture here. And the picture may be more important than the physics. But the point is that you don't have to understand the math or all these different parts of physics. You just need to get the big picture. If you got the big picture, then you can use that as a model to live your own life. And really, isn't that what we're really here for? I mean, granted, I love talking about this stuff, and it's very interesting, But the most important thing is the application in terms of our daily living. It makes a difference to us how and in what ways we're going to live. If you don't follow the model I just explained, it's probably because you don't get it. You don't understand much about it. It's so God doesn't seem like it could be real. Because in order for God to be real, you have to understand why starving children in Africa or wherever they're from, it doesn't matter, can't exist. Or why there can be all these anomalies, seemingly anomalies, in the way the world exists because of the separation from time and space, time from space, and also because of there being so much force. Again, all of this comes from the complexity of intelligent activity, which is the third part of God's mind. Now, why do they call it third part of a mind? You know, why isn't it, well, it's a third part of what God chooses to do for a job, you know, so like that. Well, see, because the mind of God is what made up the universe in the first place. The mind is non-interactive on all life. The mind of God doesn't interact. It does have a, we'll call it a definable quality or qualities, which I've described in tonight's show. That's what I've been doing, is I'm defining the qualities of this third part of mind. It is not, though, a series of laws that we have to in some way obey. As a matter of fact, the odd thing about the third part of God's mind is where choice in the first part of God's mind becomes interactional. And it gives us the ability to make something besides ourselves and to change something besides ourselves and the selves even of others. It gives us the opportunity to do many wondrous things without God choosing for us. Oh, I know, some people are going to say, well, there's absolute wars, you know. What have you even said, some of them, like tachyons do this, but they don't do that, and this and that. Yeah, there are. There are some absolutes in if you're using the question of absolute. The absolutes are not about us. They're about our Creator. You see, most people think of an absolute as something that prevents us or encourages us or does something to us. But the absolutes with God are about us doing or not doing something with God. We can still do anything, but it won't be with our Creator. And that's the thing that most people don't realize. So, yeah, you could say, if you want to be with God, there are certain ways to go about it. And if you don't want to be with God, there's an infinite number of ways to choose to go away from it. However, the choice to do either is up to us. And that's really the big deal. And I know that there are people that are frustrated from time to time, because they want to have their cake and eat it. And let me explain what I mean by that phrase, which has been probably used in many different ways. A lot of people say they want to be free. They absolutely want to have liberty, freedom, to be able to be whatever they want to be. And a lot of people think that it's okay to love in some great way, but they don't want to be forced to do that either. I mean, they want the freedom to choose not to. That's funny. And then they, further though, when they screw up or when things look like there's a big issue, they want a big God to come in or someone in its footsteps and say, hey, no problem. I'm the God who takes care of everything. And if you need this or you need that, just call God 1-1, you know, and here I am. Well, there's a problem with that particular thinking. Now, this is not going against faith. I want to caveat here that so you understand what I'm saying. The point is that you can't have a deterministic God and have the wonderful things that we have in our universe. So if you say, well, there should be a time when we do these five things, I don't care if it's, you know, dancing on one foot or whatever it might be, or praying or doing some kind of novation, invocation, or whatever it's going to be, and that should give you some benefit from God. And that would mean God is deterministic. Now, why is that? Because it means that there is some way to negate the first parts of God's mind through something that is involved with the third part. And a lot of times these things actually do involve real things, you know, like a certain item, like a cross or this or that, that will do something. And here is the problem, that you don't want to have a God that you can do a 911 with, because that produces a contradiction in what is expected and eventually leads to, strangely, evil. Because people get disappointed when it doesn't work the way they think it should, even the way they're taught in certain religions that it is supposed to be. Here is the problem. Again, it's not understanding time and space and not realizing everything I taught earlier in the first hour of tonight's show, but it goes a lot deeper than that. It's this, that the faith-based model needs to have within it the understanding that we are still a co-creator. Not that God is some kind of deistic monster who leaves the universe after starting it and says, have a good time, and if you don't like it, too bad. Nor is God a paternal being that you can dial up and say, help me, Father, or help me, Mother. Either one of those models, it fouls up everything. And the Father model is a biggie used by some religions. And it's not a good one because it gets rid of the co-creation part. The co-creation part. Ageless wisdom, which is not a religion, by the way, explains it as the opposite, that we are co-creators and that we can even pray to God, but only if the prayer involves, number one, the benefit for others besides our little selves, and it is something we're willing to participate in as a co-creator of virtue, light, and form. So we're willing to be part of that plan, not that, gee, will you please give me, because after all, I said this, or I did this, that, or I read this, or I counted the beads on, or whatever it is, that don't work. Won't work. Because that model continues to separate time from space. You didn't know that. Oh, yeah, it does. It makes forces increase and not decrease. So let's say you pray for something personal. God, please give me some more money. You know, I don't have enough money. Things are tight, and I got hit with this problem or that problem. Obamacare is going to cost me three times more than I thought it was. I don't have any money to pay for it. What am I going to do? God, help me. That model right there says that the results are probably going to be negative. It's going to probably create forces. It's going to separate more time from space. Because it ignores the principle of what the universe is about. God created the universe so we could become co-creators. Not so we should become dependent. Not so we could be making those emergency calls because we just feel this way or that way about stuff. this is the problem, and I don't have an easy solution because the majority, the vast majority of human beings on Earth at the present time are locked in that wrong model. And it is leading to a discouraging outcome for some folks. Not everybody, but for some. Now, what if you just completely believe that, and I'm not picking on anybody, but that Jesus is going to come and help you because, after all, Jesus loves you, and Jesus is God, and being God, Jesus has died for your sins and is willing to do whatever it takes to get you going, and whatever. Well, yeah, the problem with that, again, is that it makes us and a person who is saying that into the victim who needs help, and that we can only be saved by faith alone. I believe very much in faith, provided it is backed up in equal amounts or more by co-service, co-creation on the highest level that a person can respond to with God. The response issue is the ability of the person themselves. Two people have different levels of responsibility because their senses and consciousness are in a different place. So what works for one will work for the other. The more capable a person is, the more a faith, totally based, relationship with God becomes awkward and troublesome. It may cause them to eventually reject God, which is the big concern I have, because they think it's just not working. Now, if it is working for you, I say, okay, I'm not going to argue with that. The only problem is that for a lot of people, it works for months or a few years, and then some biggie thing, and they have a lot of trouble. And they can, if they have the other model, if they're using the ageless wisdom model, we'll call it, of, well, I got to co-create. God helps those who help themselves. I like that saying. And also helps others. When you get that part into the mix, and they choose to co-create with others in the process of doing so, they're on a soul level, I call it, and so does ageless wisdom. And then, at that point, we are really joining time and space together, and the forces are reduced significantly. Then you can expect assistance. I know that sounds contradictory to what I said 10 minutes, 20 minutes ago. No, I'm not being contradictory. If you're going to co-create at your level of response, you will get a co-response. That's why I said don't think I'm saying I don't believe in faith. Because the faith is that you will get that response because that's what the universe is made to do. Not because there's a paternal being, but because God is love itself and it created the system so it works. Again, religions have this amok because the people who create religions have cross purposes. They want to have more control over others by trying to give something for nothing. Every time anybody tries to give you something for nothing, run for the hills and fight against it to prevent it from going further with others. Because something for nothing is the mark of the darkness. It's the way everything is built from the dark side. And some parts of some religions have that built into them. Those religions, over time, will need to change. They don't need to be destroyed. They need to find God, because God is into co-creation, not into a deterministic process in which we become slaves to God. Because pure faith is slavery. It is. Pure faith. Faith without anything else, that's not a good thing. We can't grow from that. the universe doesn't develop itself the way that God created it to be. And this is, again, you could say, well, that's your belief. Well, it's not exactly my belief, but if you want to call it belief, fine. It's based upon everything I'm explaining and teaching about. If you have a system that works differently, then explain it to me. And I believe it. If it works better than this, I'm more than willing to hear it. If it works even close to being as good, I just have never found anything that's even close. I've talked about this for years now. There's just no other system that I could come up with. I've tried and tried. I said, well, look at it. Just for the heck of it, all this ageless wisdom stuff aside, let's see if I can come up with something better. You know, hey, maybe I'm a smart guy. Maybe I can come up with my own universe and figure it out. And you know, if I could, I could create my own universe. I could be the god of my own universe, because creation comes from that process. It comes from taking infinite field of possibilities and making them into probabilities because I come up with my own thought of a system that works. I could have come close. Not even every time I came up with anything to change this or that, it's so many contradictions and problems, and the whole thing falls apart. And I say, well, that didn't work. And I worked on some that really for hours and hours trying to come up with alternate plans for how to make a universe. And I've been able to do it. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be done. I'm just saying I can't do it. And if you got it, you know, you got my email address, you got my phone number, give me a call, I'll listen to it. If you got the better plan, fine. Most people, of course, if they're into strong faith-based only relationships with God, don't have that. Because the very idea of it being faith-based means that it isn't. You can't figure it out, right? It's unknowable. The way to look at it is, how come we have all this ability that we increase every day of understanding things, and yet God wants us to live our lives in a way in which we are completely not understanding the most important part of our relationship with our Creator? That didn't make sense, does it? Yeah. I know. Okay. But again, remember what I said. Historically, religions in themselves are created by people. And they have cross purposes. Some of it comes from a relationship with God, but other parts comes from living a life of the physical world in which they live selfishly and are illusioned in the process. All right, so let's look at time from another vantage point. When I talk about time, most people think of past, present, and the future, right? Well, time could be divided in some circumstances, the majority that we're familiar with, into those elements. In some parts of civilization here on Earth and other places, there's been even a couple more parts of time added, like the distant past, the somewhat recent past, the present, the somewhat distant future, the somewhat near future, and the distant future. I mean, things like that. Now, why would that be part of people's perspective of time? Sometimes because when a person is so much sold by the idea that time is its own thing, completely separate from space, okay? It's just a yardstick of 1 second to the next, and it just moves that way, then it kind of makes sense to divide time up into smaller parcels so that you can define it easier, like it happened in the near past or happened in the distant past, and it means something different to people. But it doesn't mean very much when time is so relative, because it's really about how much it's separated from space in terms of how it works. Let me give you an example. To a person who is doing something very virtuous and living at their level of response, their ability to think is much greater, their consciousness is much higher, and they're thinking more in creation and co-creation with God. Now, once they start doing that, the perception of time is that it takes less and less time to do any interaction with anything. Less and less. Some things may be easier than others, depending upon their how good their senses work and how good their minds work, and how much they have gotten the skill to be able to do everything that they want to do. So all of that plays into it. But to that person, time is minimal. Let's take someone on the opposite side. Someone who's very selfish, illusioned, we'll call it, maybe on the dark side, tends to use force most of the time in their interactions, very little intelligent activity in their life, therefore they're not virtuous very much, very dark in their informing of anything. And the result is that time to them is a virtual yoke around them. They can't, everything, they're fighting everything based upon the time that they have. And in that perspective, it's very, very difficult for those people to perceive what time really is. They see time as how much force can they apply to overpower something so they get things done more, quote unquote, quickly. What they're really doing is they're stealing the time from other people. It could be money, which is compressed time and energy, or it can be the senses of other people being used up for the benefit of them, or it could be their bodies being used up for the benefit of them. They're enslaved and forced to do various activities. Or it could be trickery in which they use up all elements, including the emotive and intellectual side of people, for their own benefit. And in the process, they take from others. Now, this is what evil does, of course. But just dark people, the selfish people, are doing some of this all the time. They're taking from others. And the result is it seems to them like they're saving time. Well, I got all these slaves working for me. They're doing a great job, and I can just sit here and it's saving me a lot of time. I got 100 people doing all the work, and I'm just sitting around doing nothing. Oh, it sounds great. I love it. You know, well, it only seems that way at the moment. Because remember that thing about karma, and I said that you can't escape from it. So ultimately what happens is when evil folks do that, or dark people do, or selfish people do, everything you're taking from everybody else eventually comes back on them, but not just in a 1-to-1 ratio. It could be a 10-to-1 ratio, or a 20-to-1, or a 50-to-1, because the time that they separate from the space, even though the illusion is, well, I'm getting everybody else to make up for it. Yeah, I'm separating a lot of time, and things are very hard to get done, but, you know, I just got all my slaves, and they're doing everything I want. I'm stealing from everybody. I'm stealing their money. I'm stealing their stuff. I'm stealing this. I'm stealing that. It's all steal. Steal, steal, steal. But what happens? Well, eventually those folks find that they suffer from huge amounts of time separation from space. Of course, they're living in darkness. They don't realize that, maybe, but and their own senses are actually being diminished, but they don't realize, because they are making up for it by the stealing of everybody else's senses. And the process can go on for years. Maybe it's happened for thousands of years with some dark masters. And the results are devastating eventually, because the karma cannot be sidestepped indefinitely. And eventually it comes down, and it's so hard and so forceful, it's just incredible. Remember, you're paying interest on it at a huge rate of return. Karma on evil is for sure, could be dozens and dozens of times greater than what the initial energy was that they were facing. All right, so now we see that time really becomes a means of punishment, and also, but not punishment in the in a sense of like there's some kind of judgment day punishment. But it's a self-punishing way. We punish ourselves. Some people do. Most people do to some extent. And it also has the same element I said earlier, that in separating time from space, we end up with forces that end up destroying our bodies and our senses eventually. Even if we're stealing in the beginning, if we can't steal enough, and eventually it gets, the whole system falls apart for us. And the most fascinating part about this is that the thing that is the enemy, apparently, is also the enemy of our own consciousness. I know that many dark people think that they're not losing much consciousness in the process because they don't, they think that the consciousness is just being put on the shelf. But every time that time is separated from space, consciousness diminishes, because time is a measure of that consciousness. And it diminishes as a result of the time separation, because the forces are so great that all of the mechanisms, starting from the senses in the bodies up through the knowledge-gathering part of the subconscious or personality of a person, and eventually the self of the person, all pay a huge penalty. Huge. And so there's loss of consciousness, and in Ageless Wisdom, the definition of suffering is the awareness that one has lost their consciousness. Now remember, awareness is critical here. So some people who are real evil don't notice until the whole thing just cracks wide open and they don't have any senses left on a human scale. But they don't notice until that happens that they've lost the consciousness. It's really lost, but they don't notice it. So they don't suffer until that final moment, and then do they ever suffer? Oh, my. Now, you don't have to be evil to suffer. You can suffer even in a much less way just by being selfish, but not to the point of, you know, saying, well, I'm going to destroy God. Maybe you don't want to destroy God. Maybe you just want to take stuff away from everybody else, but God, you know, you don't want to mess with God. Well, yeah, you're still going to suffer, though. The suffering is coming. You just may not notice it. You may not notice it for years, but it will come. And when it does, oh, pretty horrible. Now, here's the interesting part about this. The options that we all have include the ability to join time and space for all those who will co-create with us, regardless of their prior karma. This is hard for us to deal with, because I know that a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to help anybody who's really been bad, you know. And the weird thing is that we are all souls, at least most of us are. If we have become completely evil, we have a human soul. And in the background, you got to say, you know, as long as this being, this human being, is seeking to co-create, I'll give him or her a chance. Because the co-creation element is the dictate, so to speak, of how the universe works. Remember I kept saying, faith-based, you can still have it as long as you're willing to co-create. The same thing is true about how to deal with people who in the past have been selfish. If they're willing to co-create, and this is where it takes some wisdom to not get suckered in, you don't want to be fooled by people who say, oh, yeah, I'm real spiritual. Where do you keep your money? Where do you keep your nice things? I'm going to steal those. No, you got to be careful, but you got to also give people the opportunities, and the problem is sometimes there's no way to know. But you can do the best you can, and sometimes there are still going to be ugly people who do ugly things, even though you did your best. So you try to co-create with anybody who's willing to, and you give them enough so they can co-create at a certain level, and you're always hoping that they're going to get to the point where they raise their level of consciousness, reduce the amount of time separation from space. By our standards, they make fewer mistakes as well. And participate interactively with us so that we are all becoming more soul-like here right on physical Earth. This is a very good model to have. It does require quite a bit of wisdom, and it requires cooperation of all the other people around it. Let's say you're doing it, and you got your neighbors and friends. Some of them are not so good at it, but you're all trying together. Well, you kind of fall down in by the people who are screwing up, and that could result in some terrible outcomes. Your intentions might be right, and you're trying to regulate it in a way that will be helpful for everybody, but you still might get hurt, damaged, ripped off because everybody else is screwing up or some other people are screwing up. And you can't control that. That's just the way it is. Sometimes working together leads to karmic consequences that are a bit undeserving on an individual level. There are such things as what is called group karma. And it really does affect an individual in a way that seems unfair. Except it really isn't, because that individual should be going in with eyes open enough to realize that this can happen, and they're willing to make the sacrifices to leave opportunity, even when it could backfire and become, in many ways, destructive. It is, unfortunately, the present level of functioning on a very non-sacred planet such as Earth. If you move to different worlds, this is not the same kind of problem. But Earth is peculiar in that this is a real issue. And a lot of people tell me, well, I want to live my life then only individually, because if I have to depend upon others who, as I co-create with them, I can screw up things and everybody gets hurt, except for the people who are dark and selfish and they end up seemingly winning. Remember, they never do. That this doesn't seem fair. It's not healthy. It's just a waste of resources and all this other stuff. Well, it depends how you look at it. You have to find the group of people that will best work in the best ways you can, and they're not going to be perfect, and some will screw up. But you do everything you can to elevate everybody as much as possible with the understanding that it isn't always going to work. Now, can we do that? Sure. You don't want to go the other direction and say, no, I'm only going to live for myself because that's everybody else is screwing up. Well, you are too, and if you average the whole thing out, you'll find that in most circumstances, it's going to balance out. That doesn't always. There are some people that are much more sacrificial. They give a lot more and lose a lot more than others do. But that's their choice. They know what they're doing. They know why they're doing it. And it's not our worry to be concerned about those, because they probably are far enough ahead so they can deal with it. I'm talking about most of us really are pretty close in our consciousness, and so we could live through this system of people screwing up here and there, because everybody's going to do it to some extent. And it kind of does balance out. Yes, there's going to be some that are not quite as responsive as others. That's always the way it is. But we can work together and not try to make it an equal situation, but one in which God still is being created more than not. More light and form, more virtue is being created than not, and that's a good thing. Now, if it's going upside down, if you see a lot of time being wasted and no intelligent activity taking place, or very little, then you don't stay in that system. You find alternatives for creation. Do you change people? Sometimes. Sometimes you can say, well, some people that we're working with here just aren't going to be fitting into the system. They're too selfish. Maybe their heart's in the right place, but the rest of what they're able to do is just not right there. Wisdom tells us which way to go with that. What's the best thing to help that person to grow? Is it to keep giving them opportunities that they luck? Probably not. I mean, you want to reduce the opportunities, maybe increase the forces on them so that they will change, but at the same time, not reduce the outcomes of virtue being created. You find a level of response that works for each person, and you help them in that way. That's different than the full faith-based idea that everybody gets the maximum amount of love. And if you do that, you have no wisdom. You're giving, but the giving is unwise and wasteful and may create darkness. The time model was very important here. If you see a lot of wasted time, let that be a strong deterrent from giving more. So remember, time, wasted time, is the indication that consciousness is being lost, not gained, and virtue is being not created, and God is not being co-created with. Don't give more to people on that basis because you're feeding the wrong side. All right? All right, now let's try to, we'll say, complete tonight's show by looking at God's third part of mind as a bigger picture. And before I do that, I did want to, I think I've got enough time here. Let me see if I can get this in, stick it in here. I wanted to mention, I've been saying it for the last few weeks, that we're going to have another Life's Hidden Meaning study group that I'm going to teach. Now, you're not going to be charged on that. And if you, I just got invited to go to 8:30. Oh, my God. Okay, well, good thing I'm doing this commercial. Very good, very good. I'll see if I can talk a bit longer. You guys can stay on. I can go longer on tonight's show. The station manager just said, go for it. There was supposed to be someone starting after me, but they're having all kinds of technical things or whatever. So, hey, listen, I'll keep going. You know, I'll go all night. No, Don, don't take that serious. All right, so let me talk about this. We're going to start another study group. Now, we don't charge for the study group. If you want to give donations, you can give donations, but there's no, you know, like, oh, you got to pay this much each week or whatever, none of that stuff. The idea is here to help people to understand one of the most difficult textbooks or any kind of book you can read, which is Life's Hidden Meaning. Now, you could say, well, why did you write such a hard book? Well, I didn't write it to be hard. I wrote it to explain things as best as I could about the cosmology, ontology of our universe, how God functions, how things function. And in order to do that, within the limits of, at that time, the printing industry, I had to do it within so many pages and certain size of book and all that kind of stuff. And so that's what the limitations are. And it makes the book more difficult because the subject is so big. You know, you got a big subject, what the heck are you going to do about it? So this is where it got kind of, we'll say, dicey, because I really couldn't write the book the way I wanted to, based upon the limitations of the publishing industry and books in general. As it was, the book got so big, some bookstores wouldn't handle it because their shelves didn't fit the book. Did they go put the book on to sell it for? It was the wrong size. All right, well, that's always a problem. There were some other things. So that's one of the reasons it's a hard book. The other reason is that the concepts involved in understanding God are very big, just like tonight's show. We're only talking a little bit about certain parts of God, but still it's big enough so that, you know, this is, like, huge. And that's where the difficulty lies, too. And the third thing is the book challenges people to grow in their consciousness. The weird thing about it is I realized that I couldn't just talk about information. I needed to change the mind of the reader so they could understand it more as they read the book. So I used certain things that are like parts of a yoga that at that time we were developing called synthetic yoga that actually is part of how you read the book. It sounds strange, doesn't it? So as you read the book, you become a bit more conscious. Some people do, anyway. And it exercises certain parts of the higher mind. And in the way it exercises it, the person gains more ability to use their demonic energies in their mind, their higher mind, to hold the concepts together better so they understand the book better. Most people, as they read the book, understand it more and more. And some go back over time and reread it once, twice, three times. Some people have been in a study group more than once because the same thing. Their consciousness goes up, suddenly it's a different book. Well, how come I didn't understand this before? Well, because your consciousness changes when you read the book and other things. All right, so that's part of it. Also, the more you practice spiritual life and trying to do some spiritual service changes your ability to understand the book. That's something we don't do in the study group, but I encourage people to live their life that way in general. So that is a good idea. Now, we've got a date and everything. We're going to be starting this. First of all, it'll be Wednesday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. That's Phoenix time. You don't have to live anywhere near Phoenix. You can live anywhere in the world, and you can participate, provided you were up at the time, in the group. Yeah, and we've got ways to do this. You could even see. We've got a camera now. You can see what's going on in the group. You can hear what's going on. People can hear and possibly see you. I mean, all this is available, that is new, too, in doing this. We will have people from other parts of the world participating. We'll have people from in the United States participating. And then we'll have people physically present who live somewhere in the Phoenix metropolitan area and can get there. And it's from Wednesday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. Arizona time. And it's about a 12-month commitment, give or take. So 52 weeks or so. And if you're interested, you can contact us at thoughts@whylifeis.com. You can call toll-free 800-777-7850, 800-777-7850. And you can participate from anywhere in the world. You can do it from a cell phone. You can do it from a computer. You got a lot of possibilities. Also, I want to make mention that we're going to actually start this, I believe, on September 2nd, which is the first Wednesday in September. That's when we're doing it. And I think that it's the second. It's the first Wednesday in any case. It isn't on the sheet because I think the sheet's a little bit old. We haven't gotten a date or time yet. And so that tells you it's about a month from now. That's when it's coming up. And so you can plan for it and say, well, gee, can I really do this? We would like everybody to participate each Wednesday. I mean, let's face it, if you miss a Wednesday out of a year or you miss the two Wednesdays out of a year, nobody's going to come and bang on your door, oh, you didn't show up. No, it isn't like that. But hopefully you'll see that it's very important for you to be there, and it helps everybody to have everybody there because we're all going to be sharing in the experience. The way I'm going to teach it is a little bit more interactive than I have in the past. So that will be a good thing. And I think that most people will find that this is really a benefit to their understanding of this, what I think is an important book. And you definitely will need a copy, if you don't already have one, of Life's Hidden Meaning that you can get. There's a discount for people who are going to be in the study group. I don't know how they got that, whatever it's going to be. I think it depends on whether or not you're co-participating in various services or however it is. But there's some kind of discount, and you can find out about that. And so if you're interested, there's going to be the study group starting in September, the Wednesday evenings from 7 to 9. 4th. Okay, it's September 4th. I just got that. September 4th. All right, we got the 4th of September. I said the 2nd originally. I think the 2nd is actually Memorial Day. That could be. But anyway, the 4th of September, which is the first Wednesday in September. 4th of September. This year, of course. All right. So that should take care of it. And one more time, thoughts@whylifeis.com, 800-777-7850. If you want to just get more information, you can call that, talk to somebody, or if you want to sign up, you can do that. Okay, so we're going to come back now to today's program and talk about time, and I want to go through some interesting ideas about time travel, because most people, at least the people I know that are interested in science fiction, find time travel to be absolutely fascinating, almost like, oh God, I gotta see that because it's about time travel. Well, here's some interesting points. The ability to travel through time increases as a person is able to reach higher levels of dimensional consciousness. Now, what does that mean? Dimensional consciousness is the ability to be fully conscious in a dimension higher than the dimension that we are presently in. Right now, we are in the physical dimension, and specifically the solid or the material physical part of this dimension. There's an etheric or electromagnetic part of it as well. And when we sometimes can live and function in the etheric part. Now, in order to travel in time, you need to be able to not just, build some kind of contraption that looks like an H.G. Wells chair sitting in front of a big turning wheel or something. You need to be able to change the dimensional element of your consciousness. Now, why is that? Well, because we live only in a fraction of time in the physical world. To us, we think that time exists, there's past, present, and future, but our perception of time, real perception of time, is only about 95% the past, and maybe 5% the present. So what we call the present is almost always the past, because if you think about it, by the time you're done thinking about it, it's already the past. And we cannot live in the future from this dimension. Time doesn't even exist in this dimension, in mostly the present or future. It just doesn't exist here because if your consciousness is focused from this dimension, you are living pretty much like a rock or some very low level of plant life. And most people do live some of their time just like that. I know it sounds weird, doesn't it? It doesn't do much to try to talk about, well, we're going to get into a machine and just go back into time here in the physical world, because you can't do it that way. There's no time to do that in. Now, you could say, well, the past exists. You said the past exists. Well, it sort of does, yes. But the past that exists in this dimension is a highly distorted past that has little bearing to the real past. What does that mean? It means that so many people have so many different viewpoints of past events because of low consciousness from their viewpoint in this dimension. That's what makes up the past. The past is made up by the interaction of people in ways that in our dimension is mostly selfish, which causes the past to be mostly confused and inaccurate. It really screws things up when you deal with the law and all kinds of other stuff, like what really happened. Well, yeah. Okay, so that's the bad news. If you want to go time traveling from our perspective here, you're not going to do too well. What if you go to the astral world? What if you could, and some people can, go astral traveling, and their consciousness becomes centered in their astral body while their physical body is usually at rest and asleep here. That's sort of in sleep. And can you get very far that way? Well, you can. There's more of the present is available in the astral world, so you can actually notice things as they are really happening at the moment in the astral world because your senses work better. But not that much, not a huge amount, and still very little of the future exists. and the past, again, because people are still relatively selfish over most of the astral world, although in the higher subworlds, like the first and second subworlds, it's not true, but everything else I'm going to say is. So from the third subworld down, this is a true statement, that the astral Akasha, or past, is mostly like 70-80% confused and messed up. The reason for that is that, again, the consciousness of the people, if you average it out, is so low that it scrambles what the perception of past is. And it's consciousness that causes time, the lack of it, that causes time to separate from space. The more time is separated from space, the more the interactions of events is unknown. It's not clear. It's all based upon confused probabilities of what really may have happened. The event itself becomes spread out, and it isn't actually taking place in a specific location. It's happening in a lot of different ways and a lot of different times. And you can't interact in it in any way that's meaningful. You can have experiences in the astral Akasha, but they have little bearing to what ever happened. It's more like fantasies of right now. You just take a piece of a past event, and suddenly you make it into a new event that never really happened in the first place. And that's what most of the astral Akasha is like. So I know that a lot of people are disappointed by hearing that, because there's so much desire people have to want to visit the past. Part of it is because they know there's things they'd like to understand better, change, just a lot of different things about it. All right, so that doesn't work. Then what? Well, if we further examine this whole thing, then we come up with the monastic realm, the middle world. Now, the middle world, the past is starting to become more accurate. Depends what part. The seventh subworld is still 50% or less accurate. It has some very dark parts of it. And so the Akasha, you go into it, and it's still pretty messed up. Some parts are accurate, but a lot of it, the majority, is inaccurate. And it's still the events in time and space are still blurred. They're not definite, not specific enough to say, well, this is what happened. So your interaction with the past there, again, is it's not based upon desire like it is in the astral world. It's based upon misthinking or misthought or unthinking or lack of thinking on the part of the people involved. Sometimes that thinking, lack of thinking, is strongly related to egotism or arrogance. Okay, and so you go to the sixth subworld, it's sort of the same way. There's not much difference. You go to the fifth, and that's where things start clearing up. In the fifth subworld, you can reach about a 50 to 60% level or higher. The good news is when you get over 60%, things start getting clearer, and you actually have a past that can be somewhat relied upon. And it still be just like 40% inaccurate, but hey, that's way better than 20% right and 80% wrong, which is the astral world. So you've got a really something you can tangibly interact with and learn something from. You can understand better what really happened and how your interactions and thinking, in this case, in the past, can make a difference today in you. It's all about changing yourself as you come out of it. Changing the past helps each person that experiences it to be more able to think clearly in the present and in the future. The past is still the past. Don't think you're actually changing the past, because then you get into that temporal paradox stuff I talked about. But you do change the present, and that's really important for everybody. So everybody's able to think better. It's a good way of looking at it. And finally, you get to the fourth subworld, which is as high as you can go, the lower middle one. And when you get there, actually, it's not that much better, but it can get to about 70% accuracy. which is about as high as you're going to get in the middle world. There's still a 30% problem due to mostly egotism and people wanting to look better and to others, and there's a lot of goofy things in the fourth sub-world too. But at any rate, you get into this place where you can interact in the past. You can learn a lot. What I wrote in Life's in Me about the past came mostly from the fifth and the fourth sub-worlds of the middle world. What Edgar Cayce spoke about, both in the past and his projections for the future, came from his interactions while he was semi-asleep here in the physical world, in those realms, usually with questions he had that were either posed to him by other people or he had from himself, what he would be able to travel mentally to those realms. He had a unique ability to do that. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, again, we're talking about only 70%. And you might say, well, did you say that when you wrote your book? I did. I wrote it. I said, this is probably not 100% accurate because a lot of it's coming from this place called the mental world, which is in the Akasha there, and I don't know how much I can say is accurate. And probably 70% accurate. And a lot of people are going to be disappointed by maybe that if they didn't read it already when I wrote it. But the point is that 70% is still better by far than anything that's written today about things that happened millions of years ago, even thousands of years ago, that's true. You just don't have much accuracy in what was understood, because most of the accuracy comes from things written about while people were physically alive. And I already said that the physical stuff is really messed up. I mean, that's why we have so much difficulty agreeing on what really ever happened about anything. Right? Yes. Again, it has to do with time being affected by consciousness. The consciousness of people affects how time is accurately representing information and events in time and space. And the more that the events are spread out and kind of blurred, the more that they don't connect to other events accurately, and the results come out to be, in terms of what we call the history of things, to be great inaccuracies. And time, the more to separate from space, the less and less accurate and truthful it is. Truth is the virtue or light of the mental world. You only get to truth when you raise your consciousness to be able to get to what is known as the higher mental realm, and you can grasp the, you know, this is kind of a strange thing. You don't really have an Akasha in the higher mental realm. What you have is a joined part of time with space that is called, one way to look at it is like a continuum of truth or light in the higher mental plane. It exists from the second subplane up, the third sub, subplane of the mental world in the higher mental world is not much more accurate than the fourth subplane is, because the third subplane has a good deal of non-spiritual or virtuous kind of thinking, which confuses. And people tend to use that part of their mind for mostly selfish activities. So the results are that the ability to understand the past, which in the higher mental world is always connected to some parts of the present and future, is confused in the third subworld. But when you get to the second, now there you start getting into some pretty accurate things. The only thing is that people can't really get to the second by being fully conscious, because they would have to be joined 100% with their soul at that time. And the only people that can do that is someone who is in their last physical, their very last physical life. They can do it sometimes. That's about it. That's the only people. There are not very many people in that position. That's That's not an arhat. It's beyond the arhat. It's an arhat who is about to ascend. It's an advanced arhat. That's their last lifetime is in the fourth initiation. Some of them can reach that level. That's a great thing. But at any rate, the point is that you have limited ability to access that part of the dimension, be fully conscious. Their full consciousness is what is required. And know people who are doing that. So it is it's an interesting thing that to talk about it, but we don't have, as human beings, really the ability to be there. But superhuman beings do it all the time. So if you've read anything by some of the masters that you think are true masters, those people are, they're more than people, they're super people, they're super beings. They have the ability to go to the second and first mental subworlds. They also can reach the Buddha plane. But when they go to the first and second subworlds, they are able to grasp the past, present, and future in fairly accurate ways. They can make pretty good predictions about what the future is going to be, and with pretty good results, maybe 90 to 95% accuracy in predicting future events. Not 100%. Not 100%. That's for levels who are called fifth-level initiates. There are some masters that go beyond that. They may get to 98, 99%. They usually don't write books, though, but some of them do, but they're really rare. And they don't write them. They dictate them. But regardless, the important part of this is to see that eventually you reach a point where you can very accurately understand the past, the present, and the future. And this is especially if you get into the intuitional plane and your consciousness can be on that plane. I'm not talking about using the intuitional body to create books or lectures or something. I'm talking about actually being there. If you can be there, then you would need to be, you would not be a human being now. You would need to at least be a fifth-level initiate, a master of the Ageless Wisdom, as it is today, and that changes. That could change in time. And then your ability to access time and understand time from that perspective, time would be more joined with space than not. The ability to understand the past would be almost 100% accurate. The ability to be in the present, same thing. And the ability to predict the future could be very close to 100%, but not probably 100%. So those are amazing abilities because time has joined with space so well, and events are very distinct. So the connections between events can be followed to their present end. It doesn't mean that they can't be changed at some point in the future by what is going to happen in the future, and you should be aware of that. That's why there's no such thing as being 100% all the time, you know, accurate about what's going to happen. We can't do that. Even God cannot do that. Because the universe, while it is moving in a definite direction, you sure can tell a high chance of something happening. The universe is being co-created by all life. And although that, on an average, is producing certain things which can be determined, you cannot say, absolutely cannot say for certain what the outcome is going to be, as amazing as that may be. And that's because it isn't determined. It isn't fully determined. Now, if we're just talking about a separate planet, Earth, you can do much more on a planet than you can for the whole universe. So while you can't even get close to 100% for the whole universe, you can get very close to 100% for Earth. The scary part about that is that, from my understanding, from sources I cannot talk about, Earth is tenuous. There's a possibility Earth won't be here a few hundred years from now, for sure, 1,000 years. So we're looking at some very scary things, because on an individual planet basis, you can tell much more about the potential future of a planet than you can about the future of the universe in any specific fashion. Now, why is that? Well, because Every entity has a, we'll call it, an outcome from its own event selection that is separated by a thing called ring pass knots, which means that the consciousness of that being governs to some extent how that particular part of the universe is has been created. They were the creators. So they had separate, we'll call it, decisions that governed that particular creation. Now, all the beings on the planet contribute and change that. So you can't say, well, they made it this way, because they're functioning the same way God functions. You see? And so they still leave it open. But still, at a certain point in history, which is where we are today, you can tell an awful lot about the past, present, and even future to a very fine degree if it's narrow enough to deal with a single planet. So the bad news is that Earth doesn't look all that great right now. The good news is that we still have some chance to change things. But the chances are becoming less and less as more of the people that live on Earth are not co-creating with their creator for various reasons, obviously. Most of them because they're selfish and an illusion. A few of them are truly evil, and a lot of people are somewhat dark. There's good people as well, but ultimately you have to look at the whole plan for the planet and see if that plan is working. On Earth, that plan is not working because too much time has been separated from space, too many activities have been unintelligent, and too much force has been involved in the creation of life and in its continual propagation and in how people are living their lives. We are living in a sea of forces that are so great that it's tearing apart who and what we are. And evil has taken a pretty strong foothold in some places. So it is a difficult, difficult problem. But I will tell you this. Souls are attracted to the most challenging places, some souls are, because they seek to remedy these problems and to contribute in ways that they hope will solve the problem. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen that way, because they still have to make incarnates, and the incarnates are free, us, to choose to either follow in the plan and to co-create with our creator, and our creator for us is our soul, the monad connected to the soul, eventually God, but it's all part of a system that we are free to either be part of or not, and if we choose to not, and too many people are doing that, then the planet is in great jeopardy. We're not following the plan of Earth, because Earth's plan is to drive evil pretty much out, and so far that just hasn't worked. So we're tenuous. Now, is this going to go in a good direction or bad? That's a whole other thing. Does it help for people to get a better understanding of the past? Yes. The past can lead to the revelation of evil and of the truth of what is happening. But at the present time, most of the past is being blurred by the lies of evil. Evil uses the separation of time from space in exactly that way to create so many lies about what happened yesterday, last month, or last year, that people are living in false realities about the whole system, and it's how evil hides itself. If you can't remember the truth about what this evil person said or did last week, last month, last year, you can't see that person as evil. And that's how they work. So they use this time problem, especially here in the physical world, to their great advantage. It's not as successful in the astral world, particularly from the fifth subworld and higher. So that's the good news. But the terrible news is that here in the physical world, it's become abundant, and we call it propaganda, spin, or whatever. It's just lying. And the lies are amazingly effective because people cannot remember the past. be it yesterday or last year. I can't remember. Now you could say, well, why not? Come on. And I tried to explain how it's confused here because of the illusion of everybody creating this like blanket effect on the ability for us to use our minds to be conscious of what happened in the past. But, you know, if we could join more time with space and create a bit more light, it might work. How does that happen? Well, the only way to work it, you can't do anything in the physical world. You need to get enough people to become mentally aware so that their senses are challenging the lies they're hearing from the dark side. The lies are always things that are ridiculous. You know, anybody who can even reason a little bit would see as a lie, yet amazingly, over half the people are buying into it. Especially here in the United States, where people are supposedly thinking better. They're not thinking any better, they're thinking worse. Why? Well, because they don't want to know the truth. The truth is that evil is here to enslave people, and they don't want to believe they're being enslaved. They don't want to believe that they're losing all of their ability to be creative and eventually to survive in this world. It's too scary. It's a bad outcome. And it looks like in order to overcome it, one would have to sacrifice a great deal and possibly face some very challenging forces against them. So it's a terrible thing. And fear is the enemy of the soul, and it is the most effective weapon of evil. So evil makes you afraid of it, but not by directly challenging you, but by creating systems that threaten you under the guise of trying to be helpful, of trying to do the good thing. They'll just threaten you and threaten you and threaten you, and we reduce all freedom to nothing. This is what's happening. Now, if we're going to overcome this, we've got to be able to find the past and see the past, and that means clarifying our mental abilities. I mentioned the study group for Life and Meaning, but reading that book does exactly that. So if you just read the book, even if you're not in the study group, there's a good chance your mind will clear up enough. I know this sounds like it's so self, you know, oh, he just wants to sell his book. Oh, he's telling us to read the book so we can. Yeah, look, I'm trying to tell you the truth. It really will do that if you try it. And, you know, what can I say? You just got to try it. If you read that book or some others, it isn't just that one, but that one is a really good one. But it will help your mind to be able to understand the past better, and the truth will come forward, and you'll hear more of the lies, and then you won't be fooled so much. Now, how do I convince somebody who likely wouldn't be listening to the show what I just said makes any sense? I don't know. That's maybe for all of you who are listening, to convince some people that you think won't listen to maybe read something, just a chapter or so, something that might get them to wake up before it's too late. All right, so time is a weapon that can be used by the dark side. Time is also a way to enlighten people by rejoining it with space. The past can be improved upon, and people can see the truth of the past and then eventually apply it to present situations, and then they can see where the things are moving towards the future. Once you've got all that together, evil can't exist if you have enough people doing it. It can't. It needs this in order to survive for itself. So I'm not telling you something that is really like, oh, well, just a bunch of this, whatever. But no, this is something we really can accomplish. And it can be done. It can be done by most people. Most people have a chance at this, really. All right. The other thing to remember about forces, since when time separates from space, energy manifests. Now, what does that mean? Well, what was a perfected activity that would have enlightened form, would have enlightened all energy and brought it closer to becoming back to a state of non-energy and light, instead of doing that, when the time is separated from space and the events that the time is connected to become blurred, energy manifests. Energy. It just comes from what would have been perfected intelligent activity. Now, I know you think energy cannot be created or destroyed, Isaac Newton, all this stuff. It isn't so. It's true if you're only dealing with energy in a laboratory. It's not true if you're dealing with a universe like we have. Because dimensionally, energy comes and goes. I told you about how black holes recycle, etc. But besides that, energy is actually created by the separation of time from space. Now, most people don't know that. There was a guy who actually thought that back in the 50s. But because he thought, other people thought that by the Big Bang, proving that the universe started with the Big Bang, that it excluded his theory of constant creation of energy. In reality, they both exist. It's just that one became more dominantly accepted, and that's too bad. He was an English fellow. And the thing about this is very interesting, because if energy is constantly being created, and energy that is pretty far from becoming intelligent in its actions becomes heavy-duty forces, because remember, this energy is not joined together, you get a lot of what is known as gravitational effect. This is energy that is mostly controlled by a very specific form of energy called elemental energy. Now, elemental energy, unlike what its counterparts called divine energies, elemental energies have with them a, we'll call it, lack of consciousness state. Remember, energy and time, as splits away from space, becomes more and more lacking in consciousness. Well, that's true of this, what we're describing, what I'm describing as elemental energy. The elemental energy is in an involutionary state. It grows in its, we'll call it, ability to produce force, and that force is called gravity. But it does so at the cost of producing great forces between itself and all the other three other kinds of forces that we recognize in the universe. And it produces, in terms of human aspects, a tremendously more difficult way of living. Life becomes more tenuous. And for all other kinds of life forms, it becomes eventually the way that life is destroyed or eventually dies. Because there is just so much frictional parts, so much heat to do almost anything, the results are that you just literally destroy the form that the energy is a part of. Now, the difference here is that elemental energies don't cooperate except in one way. They only cooperate to grow more force. That's it. Nothing else. So they say, let's go get together, but the only thing we're going to do is make things more forceful. Whereas another kind of energy called devonic energies, these are elemental energies that kind of go around the curve. They're not involutionary anymore. They are actually evolutionary. They are developing more consciousness as they get together. And they actually do work together, and they work with souls to develop consciousness and life. They are joining time with space. They are reducing the effects of gravity. They're reducing the effects of elemental energy in general. And they promote life. They help life to grow. elemental energy makes it more difficult for life to grow. Life uses elemental energy. It uses demonic energy. But it has to balance the two. If there's not enough demonic energy and too much elemental energy, life dies. It still has to use some elemental energy if it is dense physically aligned. That's the requirement. So the reason why it's so difficult for human beings to live in the dense physical world is because it's so propagated with elemental energy. If we choose to go to the etheric world to live, if we could, or we do when we physically die anyway, then the ability to use far less of the elemental energy proportionate to the divinic increases, and we are less affected by forces. We still are very affected, don't get me wrong, still part of the physical world, but it's much less so. And life becomes easier, even much easier, though, if you go to the next dimension, the astral dimension, where elemental energy is actually a bit more conscious, and divinic energy, I mean, a bit less conscious in terms of its desire to create gravity, but a bit more consciously producing of consciousness because it doesn't produce anywhere near the same amount of gravity. And it causes, it allows the divinic energy to become more developed by far, and the senses work far better, and the ability to control time, space, and the energy around us becomes much greater in the astral world, and forces reduce dramatically. That means that it's just easier to live there. However, God made the challenge of living in the physical world, especially the solid part of the physical world, the dense part, because this is the greatest place you can create something that will really make a difference. It's the most challenging place to live, and the most amount of failure happens here with the most amount of time separated from space, and that's the reason, again, we have a real terrible ability to understand evil, to tell what the past really is like, if it was yesterday, and for evil to be able to put the wool over, pull the wool over our eyes, because it's so forceful, it's so easy to do it from its perspective. All right. So, looking at it from our best alternative, the best alternative is to reduce forces in the following formula. If each person were to change, and this is going to make a strange statement here, change their life to be enlightening, okay, by as much as a few percent, that would be like a couple percent change, say, in consciousness. This is going to sound strange. It would double their potential consciousness on a daily basis. So all they would have to do is 2% more of the time do something that is co-creative of virtue, be doing something virtuous instead of what they were normally doing, which would be selfish. And that would radically alter and restore, radically alter the problem of evil and the darkness problem we've got in the physical world, and it would restore the plan on Earth. That's it. Okay, all we got to do is double. But most people are at around 2%, so we want to get them to 4%, and that's a real big deal. Can it be done? Yes. How much time would it take to do it? I don't know for sure, but it is part of the plan to do that. In general, that is the general idea. Some people have asked me this: how do you restore the plan on Earth? Actually, it's I had a program on sacred planets, and we didn't quite get to that point. But how do you restore the plan on Earth is by doubling the consciousness of the people around us. That'll restore it. To get there, maybe we only have to get a quarter of the way. Maybe instead of doubling it, just increase it by 0.5% or something. And that would be a significant difference if we could get that far in maybe the next 5 or 10 years. In order to improve consciousness, though, people need to be doing what? They've got to be using a greater level of, we'll call it, focusing out onto others rather than being selfish, so that your activities will be more intelligent in communicating with others, so that there'll be more cooperation and sharing here in the physical world. That's the rule. Cooperation and sharing is the way to enlighten things in the physical world. Yes, love is the way that you do it. Universal love is, love that has no limits. You could do that in the astral world. But here, for just getting it done here, you need cooperation and sharing, because it is under that basis that time and space become much more joined, and you have less mistakes, as we call it, which is really the separation of time and space. That reduces the effects of the elemental energy, increases the benefits of demonic. Life expectancy will go up. People will live longer, but they'll also be more conscious, and the plan can get restored from doing just that part of the plan. Now, if that makes sense to you, then why not try doing this in your own life? Because if the people who, let's say, got it by reading or understanding could do it instead of 2% more of the time, could do it 10% more of the time, that would be someone who's spiritually disciplining themselves to some level, then that would make up for all the people who aren't doing it to some extent, and it would be more like it would, over time, create more like a snowball effect, and there's a possibility that we would make up for the people who aren't doing it and be able to catch up and restore the plan, even though we don't have the majority of the people behind it. So that's the initiative or initiatory factor that could, through initiation eventually, change the world. But in the near term, even if everybody isn't an initiate, the more people who create more virtue more of the time will compensate for those who are not. Intelligent activity means, again, the ability to communicate perfectly so that others are spending less time and energy, and so are you, in any activity that you pursue. And it's along the lines of creating more enlightened form. It's enlightening in some way. It's virtually an infinite number of ways that you can do this, so I can't tell you I'll do this or do that in every corner of these situations, and that will solve the problem. There are no cookie cutters, no recipes for specific things. This is about, and that's the reason consciousness comes into play, because it's constantly a creation of the knowledge that you already have, creating new ways of doing things with others so that this activity becomes more and more perfected in God's mind. And remember, it's going to be changing and increasing, we hope, in some respects we hope, in difficulty, because more people, as they do it, makes it more, the bar is raised a little tiny fraction each time, but that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing, because that means we're at least moving in the right direction. You want that to happen. All right, so from the perspective of how to achieve this goal, there it is. And study is going to help. Ultimately, it's taking action that solves the equation. Yes, I encourage people to go to the study group. You know that, because it's going to change the consciousness. But you still have to take the action. The action is the third part of God's mind, which completes the results and causes time to join with space. Mistakes go down. Evil is exposed, done away with, the world becomes a much greater place, lower kingdoms, below human kingdom, are developed more from a standard of light, and the balance in all life becomes improved. The planet eventually moves towards being sacred, and wonderful, beautiful, great things take place here on Earth. That is not a bad outcome, and we can get there by starting with some of the things I'm saying. You can't study your way there, because activity is required. I know some people say, well, I meditate. I meditate every day, and then I go to my full moon meditations, and then I do 20 times more meditations, and then I do some prayer, And then I go to a class, and then I read this, and I read that, and all this other stuff. Doesn't that help? Well, it may help in the beginning, but ultimately you have to convert it into action, or it doesn't change the outcome in terms of the plan, and it doesn't save the planet, and it doesn't eventually get you to join with your soul. There are three parts to God's mind, not just two. Too many people are more than willing to change how they think, that's the two parts of God's mind, including raise our consciousness, which will only work for a while if you don't convert it into intelligent activity, into the perfection of what that is, so it's created in form, light in form, right here, right now, and that's what we need. So I hope that that makes some sense to you, because I know that a lot of people have felt that I have been too pushy on the question of service, but that's what it's about. If you're going to do other stuff and still say, well, yeah, but I don't want to actually have to do anything, but we're here in an action universe, and this part you've got to really be active in, or the forces are going to eat you up. Your consciousness may go up for a while studying, et cetera, but you're going to get imbalanced in not being active, and your consciousness will stop growing. And you'll separate more time from space. You won't gain it. It's hard to believe that that eventually could be the outcome, but it is. It is a requirement. You must do intelligent activity if you're going to be here at all. And you are here. That's what incarnation involves. It's the reason the soul can't be here. Because it would lose too much of its sense, and then it would fail to be good in its next incarnation. So it can't lose that ability. It stays there incarnating and helping incarnations, but it gives up the life here and it creates us to do the job. We can become living souls, but we have to do it through not just study and prayer or anything else. We've got to do it through intelligent activity, which is the third part of God's mind, and that is absolutely required to become one with our Creator. Well, we're running out of time for right now. So, and I thank the radio station for giving us this time. I realize that for some reason, whoever was going to be on the air wasn't, but that's great. It's okay with me. I don't mind. and so I hope this has made some sense to you. I hope that all this program has really given you a better understanding of time and also of the third part of God's mind. Well, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.